last day of the November calendar, but before I do, I believe that we have some students from University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point Law Society. Is that correct? Well, welcome. We have students from your group every other year or so. We're delighted to welcome you. Would you stand, please? Good. You may be seated. I will follow custom when we have guests whom we introduce, and I will introduce the court to you. On my far right is Justice David Prosser. Seated next to him is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To my right is Justice William Babich. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is an empty chair, and that is usually occupied by Justice John Wilcox, who will not be participating in this case. Next to the empty chair is Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far left is Justice Diane Sykes. With the introductions made, I'll call our third case, 01-2402, Randy O'Neill versus James Reamer. In arguing on behalf of the O'Neills is Daniel C. Arndt. Mr. Arndt.
Chief Justice, members of the court, Attorney Johnson. The O'Neills and I would like to thank you for hearing this case, which is a case of significant importance for statewide real estate law and real estate owners. Adverse possession provides an essential safety net in real estate law. A person who, with his predecessors in title, has been in possession of land for over 50 years ought not to be foreclosed from establishing title to the land. That was this court's holding in Herzog. Herzog specifically held that Section 893.33 does not apply to an adverse possessor because of the owner in possession exception. For the purpose of asserting a claim to the disputed property based upon adverse possession, the plaintiff should be considered as one in possession of real estate involved as owner. Again, that is quoting from Herzog. We are asking this court to reaffirm Herzog. That case gave clear, consistent direction. The wisdom of Herzog is that it fulfills the purpose of Section 893.33, but yet preserves the legal safety net that is adverse possession. It is also a sound decision, both from the practical application of 893.33 and from following the clear language of the statute itself. The statute unequivocally states, "This section does not apply to any action commenced by any person who is in possession of the real estate involved as owner at the time the action is commenced." That is the exception set forth in Subdivision 5.
Mr. Arndt, have we ever clearly defined what owner in possession means? Have we fleshed out that term at all with our cases?
I believe that you have. I think it has been consistently fleshed out. It is also defined, I believe, by 893.30, the statute, which was cited in Herzog as well. And, of course, I think it is useful when we're talking about this analysis to recognize that there are three elements that we're really talking about in analyzing both 893.33 and Herzog and ownership and possession. The first element is record title. Who owns the property if we go down to the Register of Deeds? Who's listed as the owner at the local Register of Deeds office? That's the notice we get from the record. The second element is possession. Now, that's the notice that the land itself gives us. If we go upon the property, who is possessing it? Who's using it? Who is exercising dominion over it? Who is actually acting as owner of the parcel? Now, the third element is, of course, ownership. Legal ownership. Who owns the land under the law? Who has legal title? Now, for most properties, all three of those elements lie with the same person or entity. However, if the record title and the possession separates, then the question becomes, who is the owner? Does it align with record title, or does it align with possession? And that's the owner that's being referred to in 89333 sub 5.
Do taxes pay any part of this?
I don't believe that they do for 89333 sub 5. I think that one can presume that the record title holder is paying taxes, so it would indirectly have an effect in that. Keep in mind that our issue only arises if there is actual adverse possession, and certainly taxes have an impact on establishing adverse possession. As the court knows, it shortens the period from 20 years to 7 years if you can show that you're paying taxes.
Mr. Arndt, in this case, are there genuine issues of material fact in regard to possession?
Well, circuit court has found that there are. I believe that for a period of time necessary to establish adverse possession, that there really are not substantial differences in fact, given the fact that the fence in question was established in 1944, and the affidavits that we have, even if construed on behalf of the defendant, do not create an issue until much later than the 20 years would be established. But the circuit court has said that there is a material issue of fact, and I think that's what we have here.
And that will relate to the question of whether there really was adverse possession under 893.25.
That's correct. Specifically, the circuit court said, was there a substantial enclosure, which is, of course, a necessary element as to whether there was adverse possession. But, of course, the issue that we have here, the 893.33 issue, only becomes an issue if we presume that there was adverse possession.
The legal question, one presumes adverse possession, presumes that it began in 1944 and that you got your 20 years in by 1964. And then the problem is 30 years from 64 leaves 94, and this action wasn't brought within that time period, and you filed nothing in the Register of Deeds indicating any interest in this land, not an affidavit, nothing, right?
That is correct. I think it is useful to analyze the application of 89333 in a sequential fashion. The first question is, does the statute apply to adverse possession? And Herzog, of course, has answered that by saying yes. 89333 sub 2, which gives the parameters of the statute, is broad enough that it pulls in adverse possession. Second, has the statutory limit expired? Now, in Herzog, the answer was yes. The fence in Herzog had existed more than 50 years prior to the action being filed, and similar to our case, nothing had been filed as a notice of claim under 89333. Now, in Liemert, the subsequent Supreme Court decision, the answer to the question was no. The statutory time limit had not passed. And it is important to note that Liemert stops at that point, because it is Liemert that the Shelton versus Dolan court relies upon in coming up with a decision which we believe is contrary to Herzog. Liemert isn't inconsistent with Herzog. In fact, it follows it in applying the statute and determining how to calculate the time limit. 30 years starts when the requisite period of adverse possession has run. Liemert's facts were such that the court found that the limitation had not run. Therefore, the statute did not attach, and the analysis stopped. Liemert did not get into the issue of the owner in possession exception, because it did not need to. And it is important to note that nowhere does Liemert say, if the statute of limitations does attach, it obliterates the entire claim, even that portion of the claim within the permissible 30 or 50 years. The analysis of Herzog, of course, did continue, because, like the O'Neills in this case, Herzog and his predecessors in title had possessed the property for over 50 years when that action was started. The court in Herzog held unequivocally that the owner in possession exception applies. Even though the adverse possession started over 50 years ago, the claim is not precluded by the statute. The Herzog decision preserved the status of the treatment of adverse possession that has consistently existed in Wisconsin law since Wisconsin became a state. The entire theory of adverse possession lies upon the open and notorious notice to the world that the possessor is occupying, productively using the property.
Well, now this was Woodsy. By this time, it's Woods, right?
Yes, it was actually always Woods. It's a pasture land.
Okay. And there's barbed wire that's strung, right?
Correct.
How many feet long is that? I mean, what dimensions are we talking about here?
The total disputed parcel is 15 acres.
Okay.
Now, how long it is, Your Honor, I don't know that off the top of my head.
But was there barbed wire strung? Does the record show whether there's barbed wire strung all of the length of the property?
According to the plaintiff's affidavits, it does indicate that there was barbed wire. The property was substantially and completely enclosed. According to the defendant's affidavits and their position, they are at least creating a factual issue, I believe 9 years prior to the action being filed, that some of the areas perhaps needed some repair. But I don't think there's any dispute that the wire went the entire way, keeping in mind it kept cattle in all those years.
And, of course, there's a dispute as to whether some of that wire was broken down by the logging adventures and others that it was broken down before.
Well, right. I don't think there's any dispute that some of the wire was broken down by the logging venture. The all bus to hell quote that we see repeatedly in the briefs clearly is referring to what the fence looks like after the logging was in that area. Now, once the requisite period of the adverse possession runs in an adverse possession case, then that's where the ownership actually transfers over to possession. It is no longer with the record title holder. In fact, it's extinguished and it goes over to possession. It is illogical to construe a statute with a stated purpose of eliminating stale claims in such a way that after 50 years of staleness, a right of ownership in the record title, which has actually been legally extinguished and vested in someone else, is resurrected. The purpose of 893.33 was and is to make record title more marketable. Its purpose was to shorten the period of time to which the abstract had to be reviewed. And it did, in fact, make record title more marketable as compared to record title before the act was passed. It was not intended to make record title more marketable as compared to actual possession. The text of the statute makes it clear that the legislature was differentiating between record title and ownership. The owner in possession exception refers to owner. The very next sentence, which sets out a different exception, refers to record title. Indeed, the following sentence, which sets forth the third exception, also refers to record title. So of the three exceptions, only the owner in possession exception refers to the term owner. The other two use record title. This distinction has significance and is clear evidence of the legislative intent to tie the first exception to the legal owner. Herzog specifically states that that was the intent of the statute. And it cites the Tulane Law Review article. That's confusing. It's the Wisconsin Law
Roy
Review.
Roy Tulane.
Yes, Tulane is the gentleman's name in the Wisconsin Law Review article. That article gives clear insight as to the purpose of 893.33. Mr. Tulane was, in fact, the person who essentially wrote 893.33, which was 330.15 at that time. Mr. Tulane clearly states, the last sentence of subsection 4, which was then the owner in possession exception, exempts from the operation of the act owners in possession. The term owner, as therein used, means simply the person who either himself or in privity with others has had possession or dominion over the property during the last 10 or 20 years. Now, the effect of Shelton has far-reaching and in some cases obviously catastrophic consequences for owners by possession. However, there is no reciprocal benefit to the marketability of record title under the Shelton construction of 893.33. In fact, 893.33, as construed by Shelton, makes record title and real estate in general less marketable. Let's use the example of two businesses, two productive businesses which have existed side by side for over 50 years. Business A has right on the boundary line a warehouse. Business B has the driveway to which leads to its shipping department. The semis drive in and out there. Now, if business A is sold and there's a survey for whatever reason in that transaction, it's not going to matter if that initial boundary was established by one property owner with the acquiescence of the other, or by mutual assent, or by an old transit chain and rod survey. Let's say the new modern survey shows that there's a 10-foot variance from the old established boundary. 10 feet of property A's warehouse is now under the record title of property B. Now, the impact of the law is not to be considered in a vacuum, so the question becomes, is business A's record title more marketable because of the fact that 893.33 precludes business A from any right whatsoever to reestablish ownership to that 10 feet. Of course, the business A's record title is less marketable. Now, what about business B? Business B certainly has had a windfall, perhaps, but the problem, of course, is that if you are a real estate owner, you do not know if you are business A or business B. And based on the record title, essentially, your property is unsaleable. You are required to go out and get a survey, and in some cases the survey won't do you any good. So therefore, we've increased the cost of real estate transactions, one of the specific things 893.33 was trying to avoid, and we've made record title less marketable.
Counsel, you were getting to the Shelton case and starting to discuss it. You started your argument with relying on Herzog and saying something like, and it's clear and good law. My recollection of the trial court's opinion in this case, that there was some question or confusion about some language in the Herzog opinion. He quoted some language from the Herzog opinion, I think that also shows up in Shelton, and says, you know, how can you reconcile these two lines? Do you think Herzog needs any clarification at all?
I really do not think that it does, because I think as it's applied to 893.33, it leads to a very practical result. I think that perhaps one of the reasons that Herzog in its application of 893.33 initially leads to some confusion is because 893.33 has no notice provisions within it. And as Herzog interprets that, it doesn't require any notice. So if you are a real estate purchaser trying to avail yourself of the benefits of 893.33, it does not make a difference if that purchaser has notice of the claim that's being extinguished by 893.33. Similarly, if you have a situation where the claim is not being extinguished because of the exception under 893.33, then notice is, again, irrelevant. Now, there is another law that we are not before this court on, a 706.092 issue. The defense cites it in its brief. It was not argued at the summary judgment stage or the Court of Appeals, but if you consider Herzog's interpretation of 89333 and couple it with 70609 sub 2, I think it is instructive to understand that that is a safety net to protect the bona fide innocent purchaser, because in that case, if the purchaser had no notice of any possession, there's a separate law that can protect that purchaser. I think that's perhaps where the Herzog confusion comes from. I think also, if you do not think about the statute in the sequential fashion, the analysis of the statute in the sequential fashion, that the language of Herzog and Liemert is somewhat confusing in that it says if the 30 years had run, then the claim would fall under the statute. Well, of course, Herzog took to the next step and said, but there's an exception that protects you, and Liemert never took that position. So I think what's caused the most confusion is that sentence out of Liemert that said the statutory period has not run, but if it had, but the claim would not be precluded until 1961. And Shelton clearly relied upon that, and I think that's part of what the trial court looked at as well under Shelton.
Well, isn't the confusion from Herzog, if there should be confusion, that Herzog applies the 30-year statute of limitations after 20 years of adverse possession? Isn't that what it says?
That is what it says, that it starts to run after 20 years.
Yes. Right. So it says it applies, and then by magic almost, it says, well, but it doesn't apply here because it's an owner in possession. So when does an adverse possessor not be an owner in possession?
I think
another way of asking Justice Crooks' question, what does owner in possession mean?
And I think that that is where the difficult analysis arises, because one in my position would be tempted to say, well, here's where it would arise. But I think under 89333 and Herzog, it never arises under that statute. And that's, I think, somewhat of the difficulty in understanding Herzog and the statute, because Herzog first says the statute applies to adverse possession, but then there's an exception that completely takes adverse possession back out of the statute. But
because by definition, you should be an owner in possession if you had 20 years of adverse possession.
That's correct. And that is consistent with the adverse possession cases throughout the history of this court, basically since Wisconsin became a state, indicating that once ownership, once the adverse possession has run long enough, then ownership attaches, period.
And you're an owner, and then as long as you've done something with that land or made some sort of claim on it, you're an owner in possession or used it. I didn't see too much in Herzog about what the use of that land was. What was it?
In this case, or in Herzog? Well, in Herzog, the use of the land was first as part of a lawn. There was a fence there originally, and then it was used as part of a driveway. At the end, it was really not being used at all, except as part of the yard, because the driveway wasn't as wide as the area that was being possessed. That speaks to the issue. That speaks to the issue that adverse possession does not have to continue right up to the time that you file your adverse possession.
Okay. Not if the transfer of title was at the end of 20 years.
That's correct.
What do you expect this court to do?
I would like this...
Your wildest dreams and hopes.
Well, what I would like this court to do is, first of all, overturn Shelton, because I think that is causing a great deal of chaos and confusion in the real estate law and for circuit courts. And I think that, unfortunately, there is no way to reconcile Shelton with Herzog. In fact, if the Herzog facts would have been decided under Shelton, it would have been decided the opposite way than the Supreme Court decided it. So I think that's what's crucial here, is that the court makes a clear ruling that the owner and exception, owner in possession exception, does apply to adverse possessors in the cases of 89333, because it seems essential to me that, especially in this state where we have miles and miles of line fences that are well established, and line fences have a real significance in property ownership, and the law has continually recognized that real significance, that if that line fence is an effective boundary after 49 years, it doesn't seem to me sound policy that it would not be effective after 51 years, and there's no legislative determination, I don't think, that that is the policy. I think that Herzog has it right.
Well, now, and given all your druthers, you'd rather not send it back for trial on the whether this was open and notorious.
I don't believe, and again, I hate to ask and realize the Supreme Court didn't take this on a fact issue, but I do believe that the facts in this O'Neill case are exactly like Herzog. There clearly is ownership established by adverse possession before even construing the affidavits to the defendant's favor. There is any fact dispute, and I think ownership has attached, and I do think the court could indicate that the O'Neills are the owners. And we would have to be remanded for some other issues, obviously.
Like?
The damages and, okay. And the timber that was cut.
Didn't the trial court find that the material issue of fact is whether or not the fence constructed in 1944 constituted a substantial enclosure? Is that the precise factual dispute that the court thought was in existence yet?
That is correct.
And you think that that's, as a matter of law, answerable by us?
I do, because the affidavits of the defendant did not create an issue, and I don't have the exact date, but I believe it's about 9 years before the date of filing, which would be substantially after the 20 years.
Yes. Is there any statute of limitations in those owner and possession cases?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I think that there is not, and that sounds a little bit outrageous to say that until we remember that our three essential elements, one is ownership, and if we're saying the adverse possessor owns the property, then there is no statute of limitation on ownership. So I think that that's the correct answer. I would just conclude by saying the irony of Shelton v. Dorlan is, while it does substantial damage to the safety net that is adverse possession, it doesn't wipe out all adverse possession. It only wipes out those adverse possession cases that are very well established. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson, representing the Reamers and Weyerhaeuser Corporate Company, doing business as Northwest Hardwoods, Northwest Hardwoods.
May it please the Court of the Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin, I'm Ralph Johnson, appearing on behalf of James Reamer, who also appears in person, and Mr. James Isaacson appears on behalf of Weyerhaeuser. Back in 1999, James Reamer bought some wooded land, some property, some hunting property up in Monroe County, Wisconsin. It was wooded land to the point where, well, he even decided to do a little logging. And lo and behold, he did his little bit of logging, and he didn't notice that there was a fence there. Well, there was a little bit more damage done to a fence that was really a remnant of a fence, half up, half down, not straight, a couple of strands, not easily observable, no repair or maintenance for 8 or 9 years by undisputed evidence. This property, also by undisputed evidence, rushed back in 1944 when it was first fenced, but now heavily wooded in a wild natural area. What that made Mr. Reamer, really, by the Lehmer definition, a good faith purchaser for value without notice of the fact that there may well have been at one time an adverse possession claim due to the fact that there may have one time been a pasture fence, not necessarily a line fence, but a pasture fence of which there were now remnants. Now, does that constitute possession in this matter? We believe as a matter of law it does not constitute possession. And so therefore, Herzog, which was also a fence case, where there was clearly possession, there was a clear fence there, and the owner in possession rule, as although criticized in the dissent of that case as being circular reasoning, as being able to pull oneself up by their bootstraps by having owner include the end of a adverse possession claim. But Herzog really is not all that much unlike this case, with the exception of the fact that it needs some clarification. Owner in possession needs to be defined. Here, there is no owner in possession. There are just remnants of a fence that maybe 8, 9, 10 years before, or maybe even many years before, was there. But it really isn't all there now. And in fact, as a matter of law, this is really, there's no substantial enclosure within the meanings of 893.25 for a fence. This is just a partial fence, which is what we have by the undisputed evidence before the court. The Kleinfelter case states that. The Seibold case states that a partial fence does not constitute a substantial enclosure. How can one be an owner in possession if there is not currently a substantial enclosure? That is what we would submit as how Herzog could be better clarified, in the sense that owner in possession really has to do with the way you're using it now, so that a good faith purchaser for value without notice can see what is happening. Now, I think the reason we're here really is because Shelton, granted, is very confusing. As a real estate practitioner myself for a number of years, when Shelton first came down, I thought I suddenly didn't know anything about adverse possession. What I'd been telling people for years was wrong, because, well, adverse possession suddenly could be extinguished after a certain period of time, even though someone was in possession, like in Herzog. But I think what really the problem with Shelton is that it's not really an adverse possession case. It's really a prescriptive easement case. Like Niemert, Shelton is a road access case. Shelton certainly should have been analyzed, I believe, by 893.25 and showing that a road access is not an adverse possession matter, and so therefore the owner in possession rule and all of 893.33 was inapplicable. And if that was the analysis that had been given, I don't think that we would have as much confusion in the real estate practice that we do over Shelton today.
Well, Shelton held on both grounds, prescription and easement and adverse possession, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And you think they should have only held on prescriptive easement?
I think they should have held under prescriptive easement, and they should have held as a matter of law, because it was not meeting the standards of 893.25 that there was no actual possession. Instead, this was non-exclusive possession because it was a road access matter. That could have helped real estate practitioners today. Now, unfortunately, because of this, Herzog has come into question. But Herzog, under the facts of this case, without any owner in possession really there, ought to be affirmed and clarified, to have this case be affirmed on these facts. Now, there's some policy concerns we have to look at with the statute of limitations, both under 893.33, 2 and paren 5. And we've spoken, and as has Herzog spoken, about promoting certainty in real estate titles and prevention of stale claims. The most eloquent discussion of statute of limitations language that I've ever read was outlined in an Alabama case in 1935 called Finley versus Hardwick that says, a statute of limitation relieves courts from the necessity of adjudicating rights so obscured by the lack of time and the accidents of life that the attainment of truth and justice is next to impossible. Well, okay, here we have stale claims, but the stale claim on the adverse possession itself is stale because it's not there.
Mr. Johnson, when I did real estate law and represented buyers and sellers, you'd look at an abstract. I gather now most of the title insurance is used, but somebody's looking at the abstract in order to write the title insurance policy and decide what exceptions are going to be made, if any. You read the abstract, and you read very carefully for the last 30 years, but you always tracked it back because you didn't know what might or might not be covered by the 30 years. But then you went out and looked at the property, if you were very careful, because you were subject to notice of anything that was there. So if you had somebody squatting on the land, the fact that it doesn't show on record title wouldn't stop the issue of whether that's a marketable title, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so what about in this case? If you went out to the land and walked it, or had a survey, right?
Which both happened.
Okay, and so didn't anyone see the barbed wire? Is that what the point is?
Well, that's the point of it is, that they didn't, because here the problem lies is that you will have, if this case is overturned, the possibility of invisible claims, because the Hardwick case says you don't have to have adverse possession being current. It could have been stopped at some point, but if it's more than If what they're saying here is if it's more than 50 years old and it doesn't, and the fence isn't there, you, Mr. Reamer, still lose. And how does that promote real estate title certainty? How does that promote the prevention of stale claims? I don't think it does. I think it has the opposite effect. I think what happens is it has a more of a threat of perverse results than anything else. What you have here is circumstances where encroachments that are abandoned will defeat a record title holder's interest in some circumstances.
Well, that's, why do you say abandoned? Plaintiff doesn't think he abandoned it here.
Well, I think the evidence is undisputed that it was a fence that was a remnant of a fence. It was half up, half down. I think it was not straight, a couple of strands, no repair or maintenance, done for many years. I think that evidence is undisputed. I think as a matter of law, there is no current possession. Certainly there couldn't be under the substantial enclosure definition of adverse possession, which required under 893.25 and Burkhart versus Smith and its progeny.
What about 706.092? That's the notice of prior claim. That sort of dovetails with the 30-year statute.
That's correct, Your Honor.
I don't think there was notice of the prior claim here.
No, I don't believe so. I don't think that there's any notice. I think you have someone who's coming in this circumstance, comes in and has no idea whatsoever that there may at one time have been an adverse possession claim. If under the Herzog analysis, this fence had been put up in 1954 instead of 1944, this claim would survive, even though it may have been an invisible one. But this was 1944, not 1954, again, by the undisputed evidence.
Do you think that Herzog needs to be overruled?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Do you think Herzog needs to be overruled?
No, I think Herzog is certainly good law. I think what it needs to be clarified with the defining the owner in possession rule to take into account the fact that you have to have current possession so that you don't have these invisible claims arising that are from 50, 60, 70 years old, such as this circumstance. So I think that's where the clarification could assist the real estate practice.
If this was only 45 years instead of over 50, you agree that your client would lose?
I would agree.
Okay, let's just stipulate that.
Certainly. I would agree. And again, it's because a statute of limitations is a statute of limitations. It is harsh.
Yeah, but this is not a statute of limitations. As Herzog said, this is not really a statute of limitations. It's a statute of making a dormant what were going to be technical problems, like names, not necessarily a technical problem, dower interests where the spouse didn't sign, generally the wife, or you had a problem that a judgment wasn't very good for jurisdictional reasons. That would take care of that. But here, you've got on the ground, somebody has taken adverse possession, if there was adverse possession here, 20 years, open, notorious use of this land. And at the end of 20 years, title passed, right? Okay.
That's right.
So title passed to the O'Neills. Now, 30 years pass after that, I'll take 40 here. And the claim is, how does the title get back to Reamer? If it's the title went to O'Neill, how does it all of a sudden revert to Reamer?
That's where the owner in possession needs to be better defined, because adverse possession should allow for, and it should be required to be maintained. Otherwise, even though title may pass, there's no notice to the world, there's no notice to anybody. And again, you have the problem of these invisible claims. This case would be no different if there were no fence lines there under this analysis. And that, I would submit, is promoting uncertainty in real estate titles for anyone and everyone to ever be able to tell what the difference is on a boundary circumstance.
So the what you want to come out of this is record title trumps adverse possession 30 years after adverse possession has switched title.
That's correct. Unless, as Herzog says, there truly is an owner in possession. Quote, not just an owner, but an owner in quote-unquote possession, which is something that means that they have to be in possession at the time that they're making the claim, which they were not in this circumstance. I would submit as a matter of law, based on the undisputed evidence before the court, having to do with the circumstances of this fence being a remnant as opposed to being a real fence.
What didn't he shoot on this land? Didn't the O'Neills use this land for recreation, this strip?
There was some claim that they may have used it sporadically, but beyond that, there's no evidence that there was any anything beyond that. That certainly, again, I would submit under the adverse possession, 893.25 is not sufficient to define possession in this circumstance.
How much land is involved in this strip?
You mean what the width is?
I mean, yeah.
Okay, so I don't think it's 100 feet or so. I'm not sure exactly what it is, how much it is. It's not a large strip. It has mostly to do with the fact that Mr. Reamer had this surveyed, and the log, and it then decided to have it partially logged, and that's when this all came about. This case probably never would have been filed had there not been logging, because it would seem to be able to be inferred, because that's when all of a sudden the plaintiff decided to take a look at what was going on, because obviously it was a wild wooded area. It was no longer used as pasture and had not been for a number of years. So that is...
Did the inclusion of this land substantially increase the purchase price for the Reamers?
I can't answer that specifically. I would imagine not. I'm speculating.
When was the survey? After purchase or before?
I believe it was shortly after.
So... They had a description, if I remember from the record, which was, this is unplatted land, so it was a description of meets and bounds in various territories. And I don't remember if the description included an acreage figure. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. And so they probably went out and were told how much the land was, but it wasn't surveyed. And then it was surveyed before he logged it. That's the way...
That's right, Your Honor.
And the survey, according to the description, would have included this 15 acres, apparently.
That's right, Your Honor.
One of the things, counsel, that concerns me about your position, as I understand it, is that it has the potential to change the normal positions of the parties. Normally, a plaintiff in an adverse possession case wants to get adverse possession as far back as possible. You know, years mean money, years mean land. And in this case, the facts arguably would suggest adverse possession since 1944. Let's say the facts clearly show adverse possession since 1944. Doesn't your position promote some plaintiff saying, hey, I know it's since 1944, but you know what I'm going to do just to get rid of all these problems? I'm going to plead that it didn't really start until 1954. And so you have the plaintiff who normally wants to get as many years as possible counted in the claim, trying to shorten up the claim. And you then have the defendant saying, no, that adverse possession started in 1922 or 1933, and get as many years as possible on the adverse possession in order to take care of this 30-year problem. So it makes me do kind of a mind warp, and usually that's not what the law should be.
Your Honor, I do think that it's the kind of thing that trial lawyers tend to ferret out, those kind of facts one way or the other, as to when something really happened or didn't happen. And so obviously somebody playing mental gymnastics with the truth on something like that, I think the truth would certainly come out. The problem, though, is that this, if you don't have something like this, we do not have as much certainty in terms of dealing with these invisible claims, such as the ones we have right now. What we have here, the legislature has given this 30-year rule because, and Herzog has applied it to adverse possession, and that is so that there is some degree of certainty for real estate titles, and that has been emphasized throughout the statutory purpose of 893.33. It's been stated forth in Herzog as well. And to allow this case,
again, to be remanded or to be overturned is going to promote uncertainty by allowing invisible claims to be all out there so that no one would know how to deal with these circumstances in the same way that Council Arndt is arguing that Shelton makes it impossible for adverse possession with being much law anymore.
One way of dealing with this is you get a survey before you buy. You walk the property, or at least along the lines, and you see a fence, or the remnants of a fence. You also can go to the person who owns next door and say, I got this surveyed. Does it match your surveying stakes? The guy says, they're all gone, but we can handle it with a metal detector. I never had them staked. And you say, well, you ought to go out and look at it and see that it looks okay to you. That would have settled it out right away. It's not so invisible.
Well, in this case, and I think in most cases, the problem is that I don't think that that's the way that people deal with this in real life when they are buying and selling real estate. The circumstance most of the time is that they see an abandoned or what appears to be abandoned encroachment, fence, or whatever, that they don't consider that to have any importance whatsoever. And so, such as this case, I think that's a more typical reaction. And so that certainly is fine in the ideal, but is that really going to happen in everyday life? I would tend to be skeptical of that.
Mr. Johnson, has Mr. Reamer's seller been brought into this case at all?
No, Your Honor.
Did your client take by warranty deed or by quitclaim deed?
Warranty deed.
Warranty deed. Is there any reason why the seller hasn't been made part of the suit?
Your Honor, I could not answer that case in that I personally didn't get involved in it until it got to the Supreme Court, so I couldn't really answer that question for that reason itself. Now, again, in stating my position here, a dilapidated fence is not, such as we have here, a remnant of a fence, is not a substantial enclosure as a matter of law. Land is not susceptible to adverse possession while it remains in a state of wild changing. In other words, you have to maintain the condition of land from a wild to an enclosed or cultivated state. And that's something that has not happened here. So, again, I think that the best way that owner in possession could be clarified would be to look to the requirements of 893.25, which requires a substantial enclosure or usually cultivated or improved. In other words, this land at one time may well have been adversely possessed, but that claim itself became stale. That's what happened here. Now, do we want to promote stale adverse possession claims? That's what overturning this case has the potential problem of doing. That's a circumstance that would be gravely concerning anybody, any purchaser of rural property for any reason, because they could walk the boundaries, they could look around, and still not really know what's going on. Any real estate practitioner would have to give a multitude of disclaimers in a title opinion, for instance, if beyond what's already done, if there was invisible claims such as this.
Counsel, then what does owner in possession mean in the statute? I mean, you agree with Herzog that owner in possession beats the 30-year statute of limitations.
Yes,
right?
And that is the rule of Herzog.
Right, and you're not asking us to overrule that.
No, I
what you're saying is that this person is not an owner in possession.
They are not an owner. They are not in possession.
Okay. Well, they might be owners because they took title under adverse possession, but they're not in possession. Therefore, they don't fall under the Herzog exception.
That's correct, Your Honor.
That's your position.
That's my position.
What does Shelton say?
Well, Shelton, unfortunately, takes the opposite view of not applying the adverse possession statute owner in possession rule. But the problem is, as I stated before, Shelton was a case dealing with road access. It wasn't really a possession case, so they weren't using the owner in possession exception, and I think that that's where there's been a lot of confusion.
The language is bad in that case, then, because it deals with owner in possession, or it deals with adverse possession.
Where it deals with adverse possession, because it doesn't make clear that the owner in possession exception is not applicable, because it's a road access thing. It's not an ownership issue here. And I think that, again, it could have been done more clearly by looking at 893.25 instead of 893.33.
So we have to clean up Shelton at the pet. You agree with that?
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
So you would like a holding that says 20-year statute of limitations, 20-year adverse possession statute, followed by a 30-year statute of limitations rule, with the exception of owner in possession, and this is not an owner in possession.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And Shelton doesn't really stand for what it says it stands for.
Because the analysis should have held true for prescriptive easement, and the adverse possession analysis should have gone under 893.25 as opposed to dealing with the 30-year rule and the owner in possession exception. Oh,
am I right to say that there's not really a difference in law analysis between the two of you and just application to the case?
Well, I think there is. I think there is some. What we are really urging here is to define the owner in possession and make the owner in possession have to be required to be current possession so that perverse results are not had, such as could be the case in something like this, and even invisible claims, and to also have the facts of this particular case. Because there is no substantial enclosure, to allow that to define whether the possession is current. And that could clarify Herzog and would certainly be consistent with a fair and just result in this case.
I'm not quite clear on something. If adverse possession is absolutely clear from 1994 to 1964. How do you have to maintain the property for the next 30 years?
From 44 to 64?
Yeah, 64 to 94. Now let's say if we put these whole facts back 10 years, and the property was purchased in 89 instead of 99. Did the O'Neills have to maintain that property in any particular way, or could they have gone off to Europe?
For there to be a fence, it has to be an obvious, open fence that everyone can observe and not something that's half up and half down and in the sense of being remnants. Now, there still is...
They tore down the fence.
They tore down the fence. Well, the problem the problem with the fact under the analysis that's being purported by O'Neill's that it wouldn't matter if they were currently in possession. If the fence wasn't there now,
yeah,
they would still win. and you'd have a good faith purchaser for value without notice coming in and not have any idea that there was this new boundary here. And that's a circumstance that we would submit is not acceptable in terms of the way real estate law should work with certainty of real estate titles. It doesn't mean that adverse possession is diminished as a concept. It just means that you've got to have it now if you want to do it. And that's something that they didn't have in this particular case. And the other fact about it is that because of the Hardwick ruling, that makes further compelling reason for this, you know, 30-year rule. And since adverse possession doesn't have to be immediately before filing, that puts a good faith purchaser for value without notice subject to an invisible claim anyway up to a certain point in time. Here it's extinguished after 50 years. And there, it, because of Hardwick, I don't believe that it would be extinguished after 49 years, but after 50 years it is. But there has to be some certainty for real estate purchasers or buying particularly rural, rustic real estate will be a dangerous proposition for people.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Arndt, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. I was happy to learn that I was not the only person that felt I was giving wrong legal advice for many years once I read Sheldon B. Dolan. That was a scary proposition. I think the difference in the legal analysis, Your Honor, is that the defendant's whole case relies upon notice. And that is certainly applicable under 70609 sub 2. It is not applicable under 89333.
Well, but you do agree that the 30-year statute of limitations applies after 20 years of adverse, right?
I do agree that that's how the time is calculated, correct.
And that the exception for the 30-year statute is owner in possession.
Correct.
Both agree on that. You both agree that's what Herzog said. And the only question I hear between you is your client an owner in possession? And Mr. Johnson says no, because it wasn't obvious, it wasn't clear, there wasn't a full fence, it wasn't mowed, it didn't have a shed on it, right? It wasn't used every day, or whatever. And you're saying it is owner because of adverse possession. Okay, let's get over that hump. Is it in possession? And you say it is. What makes it in possession?
Okay, number one, under 89333, what makes it owner in possession is 89330 and the well-established law that once you become the owner, you are presumed to be in possession.
That's what 89330 says.
Yes, so I think that's the number one answer. The number two thing, and again, I hesitate, I don't want to drag the court into a factual dispute, and while I can see that there is a factual dispute from at least 1999 when Mr. Reamer says, I went on the property and I didn't see the fence, I'm not going to concede that there is not a factual dispute that the O'Neills were possessing it because they, in fact, were. They were pasturing it. The fence was there. The O'Neills affidavit said the fence was there. We were continuing to pasture it. In fact, the defense submitted an affidavit, which is part of this record, where the logger went onto the property and the logger said, I saw the fence. So our position is there's no dispute the fence was there at the time, although I have to back off a little bit because Reamer says he didn't see it. The other thing that I would note, just to clear up a couple of things and recognizing that Mr. Johnson was not involved until the Supreme Court, there was no survey until the O'Neills did the survey for purposes of describing the property that was in dispute. There was no survey at all in connection with the purchase of this property. In addition, to answer Justice Prosser's question, it's 15 acres is what we're talking about here. So I think that...
Is it your position that it is irrelevant if whether or not you are currently an owner in possession?
Under 893.33, yes. The safety net is 706.09 sub 2, which is not before this court. But that's, it's important to understand that there isn't this cataclysmic failure of the statute to protect innocent bona fide purchasers. There is. 706.09.2 does that.
So it isn't just a matter of a factual argument of are you an owner in possession now or are you not, and is the fence substantial enough? Rather, the legal question of whether or not you have to be currently an owner in possession. That's where the two of you differ.
That's exactly correct. And I think to hold, as the defense is arguing, that there has to be some possession to be the owner of possession after adverse possession is established flies in the face of all those cases that say if you've held your flag up for 20 years, long enough to establish adverse possession, that's long enough. Now, according to the defense, it's, well, you still have to keep holding it up. And so really it makes all those cases meaningless that say adverse possession doesn't have to occur right before the cause of action. Under their theory, adverse possession would have to occur right up until the cause of action.
Tell me what, once you've established adverse possession, what do you have to do during the next 30 years?
I think that there is, the first answer is, there is nothing you have to do because you're the owner. Ownership attaches. Now, it needs to be understood that if you're not doing anything and someone else comes in and possesses it, you certainly can lose it by virtue of adverse possession. That's what 893.30 clearly says. And, of course, that can be in as short a time as 7 years if that person can prove that they were paying taxes and they had a record title to that property. But I believe that Herzog and all of the cases preceding it, and 893.25 and 893.30 all make clear that if this ownership switches from record title over to possession, that's where the ownership stays. To answer, I forget which justice asked it, but how did ownership get back to the Reamers in this case? It never did. It lays with the O'Neills as possessors. It never got back to the Reamers, so there's really nothing for them to protect under 893.33. If the facts were as they claim, that there was a complete surprise here and there was absolutely no possession, their protection is to use 706.09 sub 2 to trump the ownership that's lying with the O'Neills.
And isn't that what he's arguing in effect?
I think that is, in effect, what he's arguing, and that is not what the facts are in this case, and that is not what the decision in the, that's not what the circuit court decided in this case. That's a completely different
case. It's a small part of his brief, but he's saying he's a good faith purchaser.
Correct.
Got perfect record title, and he has no notice of you because, this is the claim, he's no notice of you, our client, because it's woods, partial fence, no use.
But that's what they're
and
arguing.
Trumps.
That's what they're
so
arguing.
We send this back. Is that where he talks about 706.09?
I think that I do not quite frankly recall if that is pled. I believe it is, and if it is, then I think that would be a legitimate issue for the defense to raise. I see my red light is on. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Johnson, for an argument on adverse possession, a case we don't often hear and brings us back to all of us to our first year of law school. That ends our hearing on 01-2402, O'Neill versus Reamer. The court is adjourned until its December sitting.